Wilson opens a 24-hour auto body shop right beside a row of homes. The parcel is properly zoned for light commercial use. Every permit is in order. And every night, the compressors run until dawn. The neighbors sue. Olson waves his zoning permit at them. Does it save him? No. Zoning is evidence, never a shield. And that answer opens the whole topic. Nuisance protects an invisible promise that comes with land, the right to actually use and enjoy it, to sleep at night, to sit in your own backyard without choking on smoke. By the end of this episode, you will run any land interference fact pattern through one filter and know which doctrine it lands in. Here is the root. First, private nuisance, its elements, and the two words that carry the whole test. Then substantial, and the normal person filter. Then unreasonable, and the balance. Then the locality rule. Then how nuisance differs from trespass and from public nuisance. Then who may sue over a public one. And finally, remedies and defenses. A private nuisance is a substantial and unreasonable interference with another person's use and enjoyment of their land. Notice what is missing. Nobody has to set foot on your property. The interference travels. Sound, smell, light, vibration, smoke, or it is a condition next door that makes your land unusable. Who can sue? Only someone with a possessory interest in the affected land. An owner, or a tenant in possession. A houseguest cannot. A passerby cannot. And two words carry the entire test, substantial and unreasonable. They are two separate hurdles, and failing either one kills the claim. Under Section 822 of the Restatement, Second, of Torts, there are two roads to liability. The invasion is either intentional and unreasonable, or unintentional, but actionable under negligence, recklessness, or abnormally dangerous activity. Most exam nuisances take the first road. But intentional here is broad, and it does not require any desire to harm. It is satisfied whenever the defendant knows the interference is substantially certain to result, which gives you the trigger the exam loves. Once a neighbor complains and the defendant keeps going, the continued interference is intentional. They know it is happening, and they choose to continue. On the exam, intentional almost always means they knew and kept doing it anyway. Start with substantial, which screens out petty annoyances. The interference must be significant enough to disturb a normal person of ordinary sensibilities in the community. That is objective, not the plaintiff's personal reaction, and it carries a consequence that decides cases. In Colombia, Dara breeds rare orchids that die if the temperature shifts by 2 degrees. Her neighbor's ordinary rooftop heat exhaust, harmless to any normal use of the land, kills them. Nuisance or not? Not. The harm flows from Dara's abnormally sensitive use, not from anything a normal occupant would find intolerable. Now flip it. If the exhaust were hot enough to make a normal person's yard unbearable, the fact that it also killed the orchids would not defeat the claim. The filter runs on the interference, not on the plaintiff's thin skin. Even a substantial interference is only a nuisance if it is unreasonable, and courts decide that by balancing. They weigh the gravity of the harm to the plaintiff against the utility, the social value, of what the defendant is doing. A little harm from a highly useful activity may be reasonable. Serious harm from a low-value activity is not. Section 826 gives that balance two branches. The first is the classic weighing, gravity of harm against utility of conduct. The second is the modern add-on. An activity can be so valuable that its utility wins the first branch. It is still unreasonable if the harm is serious and the defendant could pay for it without shutting down. The idea is fairness, a profitable enterprise should compensate the neighbors it burdens rather than impose those costs on them for free. Hold on to that, because it is the doctrinal reason a court can let a valuable operation keep running and still order it to pay. What goes in the balance? On the gravity side, the extent, duration, and character of the harm, the social value of the plaintiff's use, and how suited that use is to the locality. On the utility side, the social value of the defendant's conduct, its suitability, and how practical it would be to reduce the harm. One more weight. Physical damage to the land itself counts heavier than mere discomfort or annoyance. And what does not control? Who arrived first? And whether the defendant complies with zoning? Those are factors, not trump cards. Which brings us to the locality rule. Reasonableness is judged in context. The same activity can be a nuisance in one neighborhood and perfectly acceptable in another, because unreasonable depends on the character of the surrounding area. Clanging metalwork and diesel fumes may be entirely appropriate in an industrial district and a clear nuisance on a quiet residential street. So back to Olson. His parcel sits in a mixed-use overlay, and under the Franklin Zoning Code Section 12, that classification is evidence a use is compatible with the neighborhood. It does not conclusively establish compatibility. Zoning is strong evidence of a locality's character, but it does not settle the question. A court can still find that round-the-clock industrial noise unreasonably interferes with a normal person's use of a home. Now the distinction that sits on the starred list. Trespass to land and private nuisance both involve interfering with someone's land, but they protect different interests. Trespass protects the right to exclusive possession, the right to keep others and their physical stuff off your land. Private nuisance protects use and enjoyment, your ability to live on it comfortably. That changes what you must prove. Any physical, tangible invasion is a trespass, actionable even with no real harm, with nominal damages for the invasion itself. Nuisance demands a substantial and unreasonable interference. No harm, no nuisance. Trespass is usually tangible. A person, a vehicle, flooding water, thrown rocks. Nuisance is usually intangible. Noise, odor, light, vibration. And the same facts can be both. Smoke and airborne particles that drift over, settle, and physically damage the land. Trespass or nuisance? Both. Public nuisance is a different animal. It is an unreasonable interference with a right that belongs to the community at large. Public health, safety, peace, comfort, or convenience. Blocking a public road or a navigable waterway. Polluting the town's drinking water. Storing explosives beside a neighborhood. And here is the part students miss. It need not interfere with anyone's land at all. Section 821B lists what can make that interference unreasonable. It significantly interferes with public health, safety, peace, comfort, or convenience. Or the conduct is prohibited by statute or ordinance. Or the conduct is continuing or has a long-lasting effect on the public right that the defendant knows about. Now the most heavily tested point in this half. Because a public nuisance harms everyone, the government is the normal plaintiff, suing to abate on the public's behalf. Under Section 821C, a private individual can recover only by showing harm different in kind from the harm suffered by the general public, not merely a greater degree of the same harm. Rojas parks shipping containers across Main Street in Columbia and closes the road for weeks. Every commuter is forced onto a longer detour, irritating and shared by all. Can a commuter sue? No. Same harm, more of it, which is a difference in degree. Only the state can abate. But personal injury or harm to your own land or business ordinarily counts as different in kind. Two main remedies plus a self-help option. Damages. Compensating the harm already suffered, lost rental value, diminished property value, discomfort, and an injunction ordering the defendant to stop or limit the activity. But an injunction is never automatic. The court balances the equities. It weighs the harm the plaintiff suffers against the hardship an injunction would impose on the defendant and on the public. Where shutting down the area's major employer is out of proportion to harm that money can fix, many courts deny the injunction and award permanent damages instead, a lump sum for all past and future harm, letting the activity continue while the defendant pays. Sometimes, a court grants the injunction but conditions it, ordering a plaintiff who came to the nuisance to pay the defendant's relocation costs. And self-help abatement exists, but only after notice and a chance to cure, using no more force than reasonably necessary. It is disfavored and risky. Finally, defenses, and the two students grab for first, are not automatic winners. Coming to the nuisance. The plaintiff bought or moved in after the nuisance already existed. The old rule made that a complete bar. Move next to the pig farm, and you cannot complain about the smell. The modern majority rejects that. Otherwise, the first polluter to arrive could freeze an entire area's development and force everyone else to endure the harm forever. So, priority in time is a factor in judging reasonableness and choosing the remedy. It can matter enormously, and can even flip the remedy. Standing alone, it does not defeat the claim. Zoning compliance, same answer. Evidence of reasonableness, not conclusive. Then the ones that do work. Comparative negligence, but only where the nuisance rests on negligent conduct, never on an intentional one. Assumption of risk. Prescription, where a defendant openly maintains the same nuisance for the statutory period. And legislative authorization, narrowly construed, which will not excuse negligent operation. A word on authorities. This episode named no cases, and it did not need to. The rules here come from the restatement second of torts, the standard statement of the modern majority position, and the exam will not ask you for a case name. It hands you a fact pattern and asks which doctrine it lands in. If you keep only three, keep these. Section 822, the two roads to liability and the elements underneath them. Section 826, the balance, and the second branch that lets a valuable operation pay rather than close. And Section 821C, the special injury rule, which decides who may sue over a public nuisance. Now the traps, straight from the examiner's favorites. 1. Forgetting substantial. A real interference to a normal person is required, so a hypersensitive plaintiff, or an unusually delicate use, loses. 2. Treating zoning compliance, or the defendant was here first, as automatic defenses. Both are only factors. 3. Skipping the special injury rule. A private plaintiff suing over a public nuisance must show harm different in kind, not just a greater degree of the same inconvenience. 4. Confusing trespass with nuisance. Trespass needs a physical, tangible invasion and is actionable with no harm shown. Nuisance needs no entry, but demands a substantial, unreasonable interference. 5. Assuming an injunction is automatic once a nuisance is proven. Courts still balance the equities and may award permanent damages instead. 6. Applying comparative negligence to an intentional nuisance. It fits only the negligence branch, and private nuisance is starred, so state its elements cold, with no statute in front of you. Time for the quick check, and this one comes straight from the Bargo Question Bank. A trucking company parks a long row of trailers across a public street and leaves them there for weeks, forcing everyone onto a lengthy detour. The blockade also seals off the only access to a small florist's shop at the end of the block. Her walk-in business collapses. She sues the trucking company for her lost sales. Does she have a viable private claim? Option 1. No, because she was subjected to the same road blockage as everyone else. Option 2. No, because only the government may sue over a public nuisance. Option 3. Yes, because her lost business is harm different in kind from the public's. Pause here if you want a moment. The answer is option 3. Special injury is satisfied by harm different in kind from the public's, and harm to your own business ordinarily qualifies. Her cut-off business is not the shared inconvenience of a detour every traveler endures. It is a distinct commercial injury, so she may recover. Option 1 ignores that the blockade did more than inconvenience her travel. It destroyed access to her livelihood, a different kind of harm altogether. Option 2 states the default rule, that only the government abates, but overlooks the exception for a specially injured private plaintiff. There are 30-plus more questions on this topic alone, each with every option explained like that. 5 things to take away. 1. Private nuisance is a substantial and unreasonable interference with the use and enjoyment of land, brought by someone with a possessory interest, and no entry is required. 2. Substantial is measured by a normal person, so the hypersensitive plaintiff loses. 3. Unreasonable is a balance, gravity of harm against utility, judged against the locality. 4. Trespass protects exclusive possession and needs no harm. Private nuisance protects use and enjoyment and needs real harm. Public nuisance protects a right the whole community shares, and a private plaintiff needs an injury different in kind. 5. An injunction is never automatic, and coming to the nuisance and zoning compliance are only factors. Which is why Olson's permit does not save him. The compressors still run all night, and a piece of paper does not make that reasonable. Next time, misrepresentation. Practice this topic with more than 2,900 exam-style questions, free to start, at nextgenbargo.com. This episode is for education and exam preparation only, not legal advice. And we are not affiliated with or endorsed by the NCBE or any bar examining authority.